unlearning and relearning are uncomfortable, which is one of the reasons we can be resistant to that process. Even an online article about Pluto's reclassification in 2006 acknowledges this. In its description about the New Horizons spacecraft, which will reach Pluto in July of next year, the Universe Today website predicted in 2012 that space enthusiasts will marvel at the beauty and remoteness of Pluto, and the painful deplaneting memories will fade. We'll be able to just appreciate it as Pluto and not worry about how to categorize it. Later on in the same essay Virginia just read from, Dr. Hicks noted that unlearning and relearning is deeply counterintuitive, as it requires discounting truths held with great affection and loyalty. Meta-narratives of supremacy, competition, monoculturalism, either-or dualisms, and individuality must be interrupted and corrected by building hard-won skills. So with that in mind, I'm going to juxtapose two stories, just like I did with our children earlier. The first is a familiar story, and I've adapted this version from a teaching website called Ducksters. Christopher Columbus was born in Genoa, Italy, in 1451. He later lived in Lisbon, Spain, where he worked as a trader. He learned how to make maps and navigate ships. Columbus knew that there were great riches to be had in China and East Asia. However, traveling overland by the Silk Road was dangerous, and a sea route around Africa seemed much too long. Columbus was convinced the earth was round, despite what the common knowledge was that it was flat, and he thought he could sail straight to China by crossing the Atlantic Ocean. Columbus spent years trying to convince someone to pay for this trip. He first tried to get King John II of Portugal to pay for his journey, but the king wasn't interested. Finally, he was able to convince Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand of Spain to pay for the voyage. He set sail on August 12, 1492, with three ships named the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. The voyage was long and difficult. At one point, his men threatened to mutiny and wanted to turn back. Columbus promised them he would turn back in 2 days if they didn't find land, but in his journal, he wrote that he had no intention of doing that. On October 12, 1492, land was spotted. It was a small island in the Bahamas that Columbus would name San Salvador. He met natives there that he called Indians because he was convinced he had landed in the Indies off the coast of East Asia. He also visited other islands in the Caribbean, such as Cuba and Hispaniola. After making his discovery, Columbus was eager to return home to Spain and claim his riches. Only the Pinta and the Nina were able to return to Spain, however, as the Santa Maria wrecked off the coast of Hispaniola. Columbus left 43 men behind on the island to start up an outpost. Upon returning home, Columbus was treated like a hero. He presented some of the things he had found, including turkeys, pineapples, and some natives he had captured. The King of Spain was pleased enough to fund future expeditions. Columbus would make three more voyages to America. He explored more of the Caribbean and even saw mainland America. He had some difficulties in being the local governor and was even arrested for his behavior and for mistreating some of the colonists. Columbus died on May 20th, 1506. He died thinking he had discovered a shortcut to Asia across the Atlantic Ocean. He never knew what an amazing discovery he had made. And there's another version of the story. I'm sure there are others. This one is one that I summarized from a website called The Oatmeal and a book by Ward Churchill called Indians Are Us. In 1491, nobody, including Christopher Columbus and Queen Isabella, thought the world was flat. His initial voyage to the New World was revelatory, but not particularly fruitful. Columbus knew he'd stumbled onto something big, but he remained myopically focused on gold, not the discovery of a new landmass. This myopia was partially fueled by the natives themselves, for they wore gold jewelry that Columbus immediately took note of in his journal, and the source of that gold became his primary objective from then on out. When Columbus returned home, he took 25 Taino natives with him. The Taino were the people who were living in the Caribbean. 7 of them survived the voyage. When he got back to Spain, he sold the queen on the idea of a new world saturated in wealth and prosperity. She then outfitted him with 17 ships, 1,500 men, and an arsenal of swords, crossbows, and cannons. He went back to the New World and demanded that the Taino people give his men food and gold. When they refused, he had his men cut off their ears and noses and sent them back to their villages. The Tainos rebelled, and Columbus and his men slaughtered them. In the meantime, he wasn't finding the gold he wanted, and so he rounded up another 500 natives, chained them below the decks on his ships, and brought them to Spain to be sold as slaves. 300 of these people survived that voyage. And his men captured another 500 natives and forced them into slavery in the New World. Many Tainos fled into the mountains, and Columbus's men hunted them down and killed them. When Columbus came back to the New World as the governor of the Caribbean islands, he set up a tribute system in which natives who brought him gold bought their safety from him for a short time. Natives who didn't comply had their hands cut off. His policies of slavery and systematic extermination reduced the number of Tainos from about 8 million to 3 million, and the policies that he enacted as governor resulted in their eventual complete extinction. Columbus's gold exports also resulted in the paralysis of the gold economy of Africa's Gold Coast. This eventually led to the rise of African slaves as the dominant commodity in that region, which inadvertently makes Columbus the father of the transatlantic slave trade. This is a much less comfortable story. It's one that asks us to unlearn the story of a hero who, against all the odds known at the time, bravely sailed forth and found the earth to be round and discovered the new world. It asks that we relearn our own history as beginning in greed and brutality. And as hard as this is, once we hear the new story, once I hear the new story, I find that I can no longer hear the old story in the perspective I once did, regardless of how true either of those stories are. That old story is no longer useful as a narrative to guide us, and we have to move forward with a new perspective. Mark Hicks writes that transformation requires people to give up old ways of making meaning in order for new ways to take hold. The old story gives us an unrealistic ideal to which to cling. The new story gives us perhaps a more complete picture of a man driven by his own greed to commit horrible acts against people he viewed as other. And so it gives us a lesson on our own potential to do harm. Indigenous Peoples Day reimagines Columbus Day and changes a celebration of colonialism into an opportunity to reveal historical truths about the genocide and oppression of indigenous peoples in the Americas, to organize against current injustices, and to celebrate indigenous resistance. Those words are found on the Unitarian Universalist Association's website. The cities of Seattle and Minneapolis have proclaimed tomorrow to be, in their cities, Indigenous Peoples Day. Not without resistance, of course, including protests that show how hard people want and need to cling to stories that affirm this image we have of ourselves and our role in the world. We want to believe that we are brave and strong and good, and we want our stories to be direct reflections of this ideal. For example, when Fox News reported yesterday on the change Seattle and Minneapolis have made in reframing tomorrow's holiday, the correspondent Jonathan Honing said that Christopher Columbus brought Western ideas, brought technology, brought the future to North America. He is somebody worth celebrating. That's how we cling. Stories are a crucial means for us to learn about our history. And by exploring our responses to them, by sitting with them, we learn about ourselves and what we value. We can disconnect from stories that would encourage us to continue a legacy of harm. And we can embrace stories that help us admit our mistakes and move forward with hope and joy. In the liberal religious tradition, our understanding that revelation is continuous is one of the reasons we're always striving to widen the circle of inclusion, to expand what we mean when we say we. Relearning our stories in that context can help us honor as many perspectives as possible, which can allow us to move toward reconciliation with people harmed in those stories. Native American storyteller Thomas King writes that the truth about stories is that's all we are. If this is true, then there's an awful lot of emotional investment in what we learn. And learning and unlearning can be seen as deeply personal challenges to what we know. Of course, that's uncomfortable. But in the good company of others who are also challenging what we have learned about society, about the world order, about privilege and entitlement, we can do that relearning and we can use it to build a just and sustainable world. Relearning is what makes it possible to build a village of tiny houses for homeless people, to confront our legislators about the terrible conditions in segregation units in Wisconsin's prisons, to stand in solidarity with Black people in Ferguson, as 60 of our colleagues are doing this weekend, and to protest the disproportionate imprisonment of Black men. And where we have the support of beloved community, relearning is possible. And maybe just a little bit easier. May it be so. May we be so.